hopefully the exciting one, because we will study various applications of what we have learned. So in the first week, we sort of had a first look on GR. The second week was all the machinery, the differential geometry, the tools we needed to study general relativity. And towards the end of the week, we actually have written down the Einstein equations, and we derive them from the action principle. So now, once we have them, we can start studying some interesting phenomena. So for example, gravitational waves, or black holes, or anything else. Okay, so that will be the aim of this week. Basically, we'll study gravitational waves for two lectures, then black holes for two lectures, and then we shall see what happens. All right, so I just written this here, but of course, if you started working on your homework, you just recognize that everything what is written here and there is actually your homework. So I'm just giving you the clues. Unfortunately, the clues are not very helpful because they are already in the study text. But anyway, so what we are doing in the linear Earth gravity is that we start with the full Einstein equations. So we have the full Einstein equations, g mu nu equals to 8 pi g t mu nu. That's our full Einstein equations. But now we assume that the metric actually is nearly flat, that the gravitational field is quite weak. And so then we just expand in the appropriate coordinate system our metric as the flat metric plus some perturbation. And we always treat this perturbation to be small. We take all its derivatives to be small. So we neglect everything which actually has 8 square in it. All right, so that's our ansatz for the metric. And then, of course, you take this ansatz for the metric and you plug it in the GR machinery. So you have to calculate everything. So now you have to calculate the Christoffel symbols. You have to calculate the Riemann tensor. And here's the expression. So the Riemann tensor has these four interesting terms here. And then you have to contract the indices and calculate the Ricci tensor and the Ricci scalar. And then finally, you find the Einstein tensor is given over here. All right, so that's your homework. That's what you are asked to do. It seems lengthy, but it's actually not that much because you are expanding everything only to the linear order in H. And so everything simplifies drastically. So for example, if you have gamma-gamma terms, but you know that gamma terms contain derivatives of the metric, so I cannot have two gamma terms because they will be already quadratic in H. So for example, in the Riemann tensor, if you have gamma-gamma term, it automatically vanishes, and this is only comes from d gamma. Right? So for example, that's a simplification. So it's a reasonable homework, I hope. And some of you already have done it, I hope. So anyway, so if you look at the expression for the Einstein tensor, it's quite a few terms. There is actually 6 terms. And of course, how you again deal with complicated expressions is that you actually introduce a new beast. And the new beast is this h mu nu bar, which is h mu nu minus 1/2 h eta mu nu. And once you do that, you immediately can combine these terms to many less terms than 6. So for example, if you are looking at this thing, you have minus box on h mu nu plus eta mu nu box on h. So this is precisely that. So now these two terms will combine into one term, just h mu nu bar box on that. So here, h is just the trace of the perturbation H alpha alpha. Of course, I can be tracing with just the Minkowski metric because this is already linear in my perturbation. All right, so now we can write the inverse for that. Again, the trick is that you are going on to the linear perturbation. So this is the inverse formula here. So once you have this and you plug it into g mu nu, it significantly simplifies. But still, actually, we can simplify more by using the gauge freedom. So the gauge freedom is that we can still change coordinates x mu to x mu minus xi mu, where I treat xi mu to be small, but it's basically a vector field. And so you will show in your homework that under this change of coordinates, the metric actually transforms this way. So the components of the metric change from h mu nu to h mu nu plus this d mu xi nu plus d nu xi mu. All right, and so that allows actually impose extra conditions. It allows to actually annihilate some of the components of the metric. And in particular, you can impose this very nice gauge, d mu h mu nu bar equals to 0. So on one hand, this looks like a Lorentz condition, which you know from electromagnetism. You would have d mu a mu equals to 0. That's precisely that. On the other hand, this condition can be written in two other nice equivalent forms, One of them, which Neil Turok likes very much, I don't know why, is this one here, gamma mu alpha beta g alpha beta equals to zero. So that's four conditions. Of course, this is four conditions. But we can also show that this immediately translates into this one here. So if you take the coordinates x mu, the new coordinates x mu, then you are choosing such coordinate that the box operator, so nabla nu, acting on a scalar x mu. So I'm treating coordinates as scalar functions. So for each x mu, I will have a box operator acting on a scalar. Okay, and so we are saying that these coordinates actually are harmonic. So they obey the wave equation. All right, and so that's why this condition is sometimes called the harmonic condition, because this is a harmonic condition for your coordinates. But also it's called the Donders gauge because of the guy in the Donder. All right, so anyway, so these are three different ways how to write this condition. It's just a Lorentz condition after all. All right, so once you do that, your Einstein tensor actually simplifies drastically, and your Einstein equation, which we started with, actually reads as very simple equation, is box on h mu nu bar is minus 16 pi g t mu nu. Okay, so that's your Einstein equation in the linearized gravity. We just taken a linearization. There is any other approximations at this point. It's just the weak field approximation. All right? Questions? So this will be your homework. You will do all this calculation by yourself. And I think it's very useful to do it. So by the way, whenever you see like exercise, that could be an interview question, right? So show that this thing is actually equal to that or equal to that. So that could be an interview question. So try to do it in the safety of your home. All right. So then there's one important thing is that the energy momentum tensor, T mu nu, has some general structure, which you can always sort of intuitively understand. Of course, this will be true, certainly true in special relativity. But if I choose the right coordinates in general relativity, it will also be true. And you can always think about, you know, the interpretation of these things here. So anyway, the T mu nu, the structure of T mu nu is that if you look at the TT component of that, you expect that that component here to describe something like the energy density. Okay, so the 0, 0 or TT component here is the energy density. The T and I component typically is the momentum density, or, you know, the flux of the energy. Okay, so that's of course, the T mu nu is symmetric, so the same thing is over here. So the flux of energy will be over here. And then what you find in the IJ components is related to pressures. So it's something like stress tensor related to pressures as you know it.
This is coordinate dependent, right?
But this is?
Coordinate dependent, this decomposition.
Of course.
So like which observer sees these energy densities and momentum?
That is a clever way how you can extract these things from the observer. So for example, if you're an observer, a real physical observer described by four velocity u mu, then what you would expect that u mu is something like energy density perceived by that observer. Okay, so that would be coordinate independent statement. Of course, here I'm using some nice coordinates where, right. So now this is the general statement how T mu nu sort of looks like for every T mu nu. You can explicitly check this, right? So you take your favorite T mu nu of the perfect fluid, and you check indeed the TT component will be something like rho, and then here you will have PPP. And here you will have probably zero if you are writing everything in the frame which is static with respect to the fluid and so on. You can take energy momentum tensor of electromagnetic field. Then you will find here something like E squared plus B squared, the energy density. And here you will find something like pointing vector E cross B, right? And here you will find some ugly pressures and ugly stresses due to the electromagnetic field. Take another T mu nu and you will find the same thing. So this is basically the general structure if you have some nice coordinates. All right, so now let me use that, and you will again do this in your homework, so that's why I'm going super fast over this, is that, okay, so in the Newtonian limit, what you are really doing, so you have this structure, you have energy density, the flux of energy, and the pressures. And so for typical non-relativistic systems where the motions are slow, and whatever, the fall off is the following. The energy density is the dominant contribution of the energy momentum tensor. So this is the most dominant thing, which always survives, something like rest energy, right? Even if you are moving super slowly, this rest energy mc square is huge, right? So this is typically the dominant contribution. Then the next dominant contribution will be that of the energy flux, okay? And typically pressures super small. So they are suppressed, we have seen, well, not really, but P over C squared. So the pressures are super small. And so if you are getting, getting to a Newtonian approximation, in the first case, you just take this to be non-trivial. Then you can add that to be non-trivial. And finally, if you are really relativistic and whatever, then you can add pressures as well. Okay. So the first step was just to take the energy density. So you are just taking TT component here, and then you're taking the energy flux zero, and you are taking the pressures equal to zero. So that's the first approximation you can ever make. And so then you look at this equation here, box on h mu nu bar and 16 pi g t mu nu. Of course, the only component is the TT component here. And so if you define phi to be minus quarter h 0 bar, then you find, and of course, here we are assuming static field. So this equation precisely reduces to the Laplace equation for your Newtonian potential phi. You can check that this definition of this phi is exactly the same definition of the phi we have had long time ago. All right, and then the geodesic equation will just give you A equals to minus gradient of phi. So we just recover the standard electrostatics, or because this is actually gravitational field, so gravitostatics, as was known to Newton or Laplace. All right, so that's the dominant thing here. So then, as I said, the next step would be to go the next order. And so now we allow for slowly moving sources. And so we include this, energy fluxes here. And so then you can combine this rho and j into j mu here. And then you can also define a mu to be h0 mu bar. And then you find that your Einstein equation actually reduces to something like box on a mu minus 4 pi j mu. And your Lorentz gauge condition for gravity reduces to this thing here. And so you just recovered exactly the Maxwell equations. So in the next order, you recover the Maxwell equations. If in addition you also consider sort of quasi-static field, so of course in the quasi-static field I could change this to Laplace, but anyway, so I'm considering sort of quasi-static field, then the geodesic equation reduces to this beautiful equation, which is something like Lorentz force law. Right? The only difference is this 4 here. Okay, and of course another difference is that you would have ma equals to q times e minus 4 v times v. So what you are saying is that q, the charge, is actually equal to the mass. Right? We know that inertial mass is equal to the gravitational mass according to the equivalence principle. Right? So we are also getting the Lorentz force out of here. And so because this sort of reminds electromagnetism, this is called gravitomagnetism. All right, and it's basically telling you, yeah, my theory of gravity, at least in the second, when I take some relativistic effects into account, at least knows precisely the same thing as electromagnetism, as Maxwell equations. Of course, this is only at the linear level, so we would have to go then to next order, and next order, and next order, or whatever. And of course, the full GR is much more complicated than just electromagnetic field, right? But this would be the next approximation. But then, of course, what comes out of here is that then that in Maxwell theory, of course, I have electromagnetic waves. So these are simply solutions that even in the absence of sources, I can find electromagnetic waves which propagate at the speed of light, and they can propagate through vacuum on their own. So now, because of course, in this order already, the Einstein gravity looks like Maxwell's theory, it's quite natural that gravitational waves will exist in full Einstein's gravity. And what probably you can guess from here is that they will propagate at the speed of light through vacuum. All right? So this already, so this is an indication that gravitational waves actually should exist. Well, of course, at this level, they do exist, right? So now, Gravitational waves are quite interesting objects. And interestingly, you can find gravitational waves already, well, at the full nonlinear level of gravitational field. Okay, you don't need to linearize gravity as people typically think, because that's what's taught in the courses, is that, you know, typically people linearize and then they study small perturbations around the flat metric. That's certainly possible, and we will do that as well. But at the same time, there are full nonlinear solutions which describe gravitational waves where the field does not have to be weak, and it's just, you know, a super strong gravitational wave propagating through space-time. And there are some exact solutions known to full Einstein gravity. Yes?
I was wondering, for a given configuration, if we know that two planets are moving, how do we find the sources? How do we find the energy momentum tensor?
Aha.
To solve the...
We will do it, don't worry. So if you have that question after we have gone through all the calculation, please ask again. Yeah, but we will do that calculation precisely. All right, so let us start section 5, so chapter 5, which will be applications. Applications. And the first application, so part 1, will be gravitational waves. Yes.
What are the?
Very good. So they will be related to the potential A precisely in the same way as they would be in the electromagnetic case. So for example, you know that E is minus gradient of phi minus dA over dt. So this is precisely what you would do here.
Okay. Do they have physical?
The E's and B's?
Yeah.
Well, this is basically a geodesic equation, right? So what I'm saying, I'm getting this equation out of geodesic equation. So these things are really related to derivatives of the metric. So they are something like Christoffel symbols, right? So I'm getting these E's and B's from Christoffel symbols. So they have meaning in the given coordinate system, right? But but they are not tensors. They are Lorentz tensors. So if you are around flat space, you can check that the Christoffel symbols and you just allow transformation going from flat space to flat space, Minkowski, well, Lorentz transformations. Of course, if you look at the transformation properties of the Christoffel symbols or of the connection, then they will be tensors, right? Because there's this annoying d square term which actually vanishes if you are just allowing Lorentz transformations. All right, so now let us consider, as I said, we can consider the full general relativity, and there are gravitational wave solutions, which you can explicitly write down. But let's not do that. Let's just go the LIGO way, right? So we know that we live only almost in flat space, and so we want to measure gravitational waves produced somewhere else. And they are typically very weak, so the gravitation, you know, this weak field approximation is correct one. All right, so consider vacuum solutions of weak field equations. And so what we are doing is that we are taking this thing here, the weak field equation here, and of course we are interested in the case when we have waves propagating in vacuum, so we are setting t equal to 0. So we have an equation box on h mu nu bar equals to 0. So we have box on h mu nu bar equals to 0. That's the equation which we want to solve. Of course, what we can do is that we can trace this equation. So we can multiply this by eta mu nu, right? And so eta mu nu just goes through the box, and that's what defines h bar. So we are concluding from here is that box on h bar, the trace of h mu nu is also 0. But if you look at this equation here, then if you have box on h mu nu is box on h mu nu bar, and the difference is box on h bar, right? But h bar, boxon h bar is actually zero. So we also conclude that boxon h mu is zero. So from here, it also follows then box on h mu nu equals to zero. So that's our equation for the perturbation. That's the vacuum equation for the perturbation. And of course, we can try to seek the solutions in you know, in terms of the wave equations or in terms of the Fourier modes. So seek the solution in the form h mu nu is just epsilon mu nu e to I k alpha x alpha, where this will be our polarization tensor. And this will be our k alpha will be our wave vector. So we can try to seek the solutions of this equation in this form. Of course, epsilon mu nu can in principle depend on k. But if I just, okay, it can depend on k. If I'm doing just one mode in the Fourier expansion. All right, so now I act with box on this thing here. So it's just d over dx alpha, d over dx alpha. And if epsilon mu nu is just a function of k, it doesn't do anything. So the only appearance of x alpha is over here. And it just brings I k alpha down and I k alpha down again. Okay, so then box on h mu nu equals to zero just implies that I k alpha n times the exponential, so that k square equals to zero. Okay? So that's what we are getting from this ansatz here. We just differentiate the exponential twice. And we are getting that k square, the wave vector, actually has to be null. Of course, what that tells you is that the wave propagates at the speed of light. Okay? So gravitational waves propagate at the speed of light. All right, and so we basically, yes?
Do gravitational waves in strong gravity also propagate at the speed of light?
Yeah. Yeah, with respect to what? But yes, they do. They do. All right. So we found that the gravitational wave propagates at the speed of light. This was actually is an interesting story behind this conclusion. You see, it's just two-line calculation or one-line calculation. So first, of course, this everything about gravitational waves was basically calculated by Einstein immediately after he formulated his theory, to something like 1916 or whatever. So he has found everything you need to know about gravitational waves, everything we will be discussing today and tomorrow. So he found, yeah, gravitational waves have to have k squared equal to zero, so they propagate at the speed of light. He found how the gravitational waves are produced in some isolated system, for example, a collision of binary star system. He found the amazing quadrupole formula for how much energy is actually radiated away in this collision and so on. All right, but then actually people started questioning all these results. And in particular, you know, there was this huge confusion about the gauge fixing, right? Because we know that gravity is a gauge theory. There's this gauge freedom of changing coordinates from one to another coordinate system, right? And so then they were not really sure, you know, how to extract the true degrees of freedom and how to really say what is physical and what is just a coordinate artifact, right? So whether what we are actually seeing here, if I choose different coordinates, whether this will actually not be broken, right? So then people started questioning everything was done. And then there was a famous physicist who said, well, gravitational waves actually do not propagate at the speed of light, but they propagate at the speed of thought. Because we just think that we fixed the coordinate system and then we found some propagation speed, but maybe if we fix some other coordinate system, it will propagate differently. And then Einstein himself, actually, according to some story which I had at one conference, wrote in the 30s a paper which actually denied all gravitational waves. So he basically renounced everything what he has done in the 1916 and basically wrote a paper that gravitational waves did not exist. Fortunately for him, actually this paper was sent to a referee who did understand general relativity and actually sent back a report and told Einstein, you know, this is wrong because of this, this and that. You should reconsider, you know, this paper. And of course, Einstein was really mad at the beginning. And I said, why send you the paper to publish, not to send it to a referee, right? But then actually he thought about it and he withdrew the paper. And so actually gravitational waves do exist. Okay. All right, so we have that story, but really they do propagate at the speed of light. All right. So now the next thing is really to gauge fix and see what is physical about these gravitational waves and what we can gauge away. And so in other words, we want to actually restrict what this polarization tensor can be. So now the next step is to fixing the polarization tensor. It will be interesting for me to try one day to send to a journal reply, I send you the paper to publish, not to. Okay, so fixing the polarization tensor. And so, of course, we can use this Lorentz gauge condition to actually kill some of the components of H mu nu, or in other words, to kill some of the components of epsilon mu nu. So now there's many ways how to do it. I will do the most ugly one here in the lecture, which doesn't make any sense, and it's quite ugly, and it's very non-intuitive. Then tomorrow, you will do, in your tutorial, very explicit, nice version of this gauge fixing. It's called light cone gauge fixing, where you will choose some special coordinates, and you really write down everything explicitly. And you will see explicitly how everything decouples into various modes and stuff like that. And you will see everything explicitly. So you know, if you don't like the way I will do it here, just wait for tomorrow. There's another way, which is the fancy way of cosmology, which is the SVT decomposition. So basically, you decompose your modes into something which behaves like a scalar, like a vector, and like a tensor with respect to the rotation group. And then you can, again, identify the true degrees of freedom by doing some nice explicit gauge fixing. Wait for that for your cosmology course. Okay, you will do that explicitly in the cosmology course.
So when we do the Donder gauge, we're still having some constraints, or where are you gauge fixing again?
I will show you in a minute. So I will do the ugly way of gauge fixing here. All right, so the first thing is that we have imposed the harmonic gauge. So harmonic gauge, or the Lorentz gauge, or whatever. So we have this ansatz for H mu nu. That's our ansatz for H mu nu. And then epsilon mu nu can depend on k. And we just want to plug that ansatz into this relation here and see what it gives you. OK, so now for that, of course, I have to write down what this H mu nu bar is. So it's H mu nu minus 1 half H eta mu nu. And then I use my expansion for H mu nu and for H. OK, so then it's not surprising that harmonic gauge just gives you the condition like this, epsilon mu nu minus 1 half epsilon k nu equals to 0. OK, so that's, if you write down the harmonic gauge condition with this ansatz here. OK, well, of course, epsilon is just the trace of epsilon. It's just that. So it's precisely, basically, you can see it from the definition of H mu nu bar. All right, so that's the harmonic gauge condition. And of course, you know, this represents four equations for my epsilon mu nu. So given k mu, I have four conditions for what my polarization tensor epsilon mu nu is. So this is four conditions. For epsilon mu nu. OK, however, I am in vacuum. And if you are in vacuum, you still have extra degrees of freedom. You can still actually gauge fix more. So there is still, I never liked this argument. But anyway, so there is still, it's the ugly way. There is still a residual degree of residual gauge degree of freedom. Gauge freedom.
Yes.
So namely, I can still do the coordinate transformations, x mu to x mu minus psi mu, such that I preserve my harmonic gauge condition, such that this is still true. So that's still this thing here, h mu nu plus d mu psi nu plus d nu psi mu, so that box on x mu, on the new x mu, is equal to zero. Okay? But of course, if box on the x mu prime is equal to zero, okay, so what is my x mu prime? It's just x mu, which is the original one, which had to satisfy the harmonic gauge condition, minus xi mu. Okay? So what it means is that, actually this means that I have to satisfy this condition here, right? Because my original coordinates did satisfy the harmonic gauge. That's written over there. That's the constraints from the harmonic gauge. But now I can still do such coordinate transformations so that the xi mu satisfy box on xi mu equals to zero. And if that is the case, my new coordinates will still satisfy the harmonic gauge. All right. So now the next step is to say, let's do the same Fourier decomposition for xi mu as we are doing for the wave. Okay, so then we have xi mu tilde, which is the k space xi mu, and then e to I k alpha x alpha. Okay, so then we are using the same Fourier decomposition as for the wave, where this is just the k space representation of
I'm not seeing how the being in the vacuum give you that extra.
I don't see. Wait. Okay. Now. Thank you. That's very good. So this is this, okay. So this is just a Fourier decomposition of that. So now I use the fact that I'm in vacuum. Vacuum equations give me that k square equals to zero. Okay. So since in vacuum, we know that k square is equal to zero. Okay, so that's the condition which we derive based on. Yes.
Is it the same k? We confuse.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So I have to choose the same k here as the k there. Okay, that's what I'm doing. I'm decomposing my psi in the same Fourier mode, if you want. It's the same k mode for that. And of course, if I take this ansatz, plug it here, okay? So again, the only dependence on x is through this kx alpha. So what it will do is, again, it breaks down the k square. So this thing just becomes, the box on xi mu just becomes k square xi mu e to ikx, right? But k square is zero. So this condition is automatically satisfied. So box on xi mu equals to zero is automatically satisfied for any xi mu tilde. Okay? Because I just write, this thing here, I plug it here, I know that k square equals to zero, and so box on xi mu equals to zero will be satisfied for any xi mu tilde. All right, so what it means is that actually I can choose any xi mu tilde, and this will still be a harmonic gauge. Okay, so let's choose some xi mu tilde. So now I'm choosing this xi mu tilde in the k space. So then my h mu nu So looking at this thing here, it means that we can go from epsilon mu nu to epsilon mu nu plus I k mu psi nu tilde. This is in k space plus I k nu psi mu tilde. Okay, so if I start with some epsilon mu nu, I can do this, which is nothing else than this condition here, but now in the k space. But because I can choose this psi mu and psi nu tilde, whatever I need, so this actually, I have four at my disposal, and so I can actually kill another four components of epsilon mu nu. So kill another four components of epsilon mu nu. Okay, so I can kill another four components of epsilon mu nu.
I didn't get that argument. Can you go again?
Okay, so you happy with this, with the fact that if I just impose this thing, it's four equations, and I can actually kill four components of epsilon mu nu from there? You happy with that?
Yeah.
Okay, so then the statement is that even though I have gauge fixed already, there's still some residual gauge degree of freedom. The statement is I can still change coordinates for such psi mu and the correspondingly also the metric, so that I preserve the gauge condition. So if in my old coordinates x mu, box on x mu was zero, I can still go to my x mu prime, which is given x mu minus psi mu, so that this is still equal to zero. Okay, so that's what we are restricted to these types of coordinate transformations. But now if you plug in what x mu prime is, it's box on psi mu and minus box on psi mu. Okay, so the original satisfies the equation, so I'm getting that box on psi mu has to be equal to zero. Okay, so that's the thing. So now the step is, well, okay, let's find the corresponding solution for psi mu. Well, let's see, can I actually, you know, what can I choose for psi mu? And the statement is, if you choose an ansatz for psi mu in this way, well, this is exactly the same k and exactly the same x. Well, it's the same ansatz as over there. Then, if I plug it here, I will have box on this thing. So this does not depend on x. It only I have to differentiate the exponential. And what will it do? It will bring down ak alpha, ik alpha. So k square times the original solution. But I know that k square is equal to zero because I have derived that for the waves. So this will be actually always true because k square is equal to zero. So if I'm choosing this ansatz and I am in vacuum, meaning k square equals to zero, this will always be true for any these psi mu tilde, whatever these psi mu tilde are. So I can choose four independent psi mu tilde. So now if I write this transformation here in the k space, this is what you get. Try it. Okay. And so, of course, if I start with whatever epsilon mu nu originally, now I can kill sort of four components of this epsilon mu nu by choosing whatever this psi nu tilde can be. Don't worry. You will see it very explicitly tomorrow using a different argument. All right. So that's the key step, that I can kill another four components of epsilon. Whatever the epsilon mu nu I can start with, I can choose psi nu to be such that I, let's say, four components will vanish. So in total, I killed eight components. I killed four there and an additional four here. Okay, so then, so specifically, if you have a wave propagating for gravitational wave propagating in the x direction, you can show that the remaining epsilon mu nu is super simple. I simply start this epsilon mu nu is described by 10 components, and I kill four here and four there. So I am left with only two non-trivial components. All right, so then epsilon mu nu can be shown to be given by, okay, so I have t, x, y, and z. So now I'm propagating in the x direction, and you can show that you can make this. So this is t, x, y, and z. So you can make these guys equal to zero. And it has to be symmetric, so these guys are equal to zero. But moreover, you can make these guys equal to zero. And it's symmetric, so these guys are equal to zero. Okay, so the only thing which is non-trivial is this 2 by 2 matrix here. And then this has to be given by only two components of the matrix. So I have 10 minus 8. Okay, and so you can write them as epsilon plus minus epsilon plus epsilon cross, okay? So we have only two components here. The epsilon plus is one component, and the other component is epsilon cross. This is cross. And that is cross. And so we can show by explicitly fixing what this psi nu are, and by using that equation, that you can always bring epsilon mu nu into this form. So we have only two components, epsilon plus and epsilon cross, and they precisely correspond to 2 degrees of freedom, which are left. So these correspond to 2 degrees of freedom, which is precisely 2 polarizations of the gravitational waves. Okay, so we have 2 polarizations of gravitational waves, which, of course, once you quantize the gravitational field, if you can, will correspond to 2 spins degrees of freedom of the graviton. 2 spin degrees of freedom. So we have 2 polarizations of gravitational waves. Okay. Everybody is more or less with me?
What do you mean by 2 spins?
Oh, I didn't say that. This is everything classical, right? So there's no spin.
Electromagnetic wave also have 2 degrees of freedom, but it has spin one.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'll discuss that in a minute. I'll tell you something, but. Well, of course, here everything is classical. So what I can conclude here really is that I have just a gravitational wave which propagates 2 polarizations, right? Epsilon plus and epsilon cross. All right. So by the way, you know this choice. So in order to really massage the polarization tensor into this form, then I had to choose the right psi nu tilde and you know the right. Thing over there, okay. So you see that such, you know, this is a gauge fixed polarization tensor, and it's such that if you look at the trace of the metric, it's epsilon plus minus epsilon plus, so the trace is zero. So this is called traceless. And moreover, we are saying that well, we consider the wave which is propagating in the x direction, but you see that the non-trivial components of the polarization tensor are in the y and z direction. So this is a transverse wave. Okay, so this is in the traceless transverse gauge. So that's what we have done. So we have completely gauge fixed. So now really the remaining thing are physical degrees of freedom. We have 2 degrees of freedom, and our gauge is called transverse and traceless because the resulting tensor is traceless and it's transverse to the propagation of the waves. All right. So now, yes?
But it is not exactly another gauge fixing, right? It is just a condition that you get from the gauge fixing.
Well, what else it is, right? So it is a gauge fixing. So you gauge fix a little, and then you see, well, actually, I can gauge fix a little bit more. Just preserving the previous gauge fixing, I can do a little bit more. So what you are really doing is
the first gauge fixing is the one that gives you these conditions to gauge fix again, but it's not like gauge fixing again.
Of course it is. No, we can discuss this a little bit more. But what you are really doing is that what does it mean, gauge fixing, right? So what is my freedom in gravity? My freedom in gravity is the freedom to change coordinates. I start with some coordinate system, my equation looks horrible, but I can actually specify my coordinates to be special so that my horrible expression simplifies. This is precisely what we are doing. So we are actually choosing such coordinates x mu so that both things are true. That you know, that box on x mu equals to zero, but moreover, I can also kill, you know, this additional thing here.
Where are the four conditions you impose on the excite of this?
Where?
You need to impose four conditions, right?
Yeah.
First four conditions is already the orthogonality between k mu and epsilon mu nu.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one here, like, what's the choice that you've made? What are the?
I think it's precisely the choice that I can make when it's these three things, and I can make the trace equal to zero. I think. I would have to check, but yeah, you really have to combine both these things, and then you can see that you can arrive at this form. But as I said, you will arrive at it tomorrow in a completely different way and much nicer way, very explicit one. But you will really derive this form, right? You will explicitly see everything. All right, so we have that. So now you may be asking, what does a gravitational wave really do, right? So the best thing to see what the gravitational wave does when it passes by is, of course, you have a gravitational field. The gravitational field has some tidal forces. These tidal forces start moving objects, right? So the best thing to look at would be a ring of test particles. So what does it do? So superposition of the wave. This, of course, is a comment on that. So now we have this ring of particles. And of course, we see that the epsilon is noticeable only in y and z direction. So we place this ring of particles in y and z direction, and we let the wave propagate in the x direction. So I don't, in the electromagnetism, you would draw something like that, that the wave is propagating that way or whatever. So now we can start. So let's consider the epsilon plus polarization. And the statement is, if I consider the epsilon plus polarization, meaning I'm just setting here epsilon plus equal to something and epsilon cross equal to zero. So I'm killing these components, and I just consider that wave. All right, so then if you start with a ring of particles, so let's say there's some center to the ring, the gravitational wave propagates this way, and it hits this ring of the particles. So I have lots of particles on the ring. Okay, so this is the configuration before the gravitational wave comes in. And then later on, you will see that the ring is actually squashed. So this is equal to t equal to 1. The ring actually becomes squashed in this direction. And then at t equal to 2, you will see that, again, it restores to the original thing, t equals to 2. And then later on, you will see that it gets squashed in this direction, t equals to 3. And then t equals to 4, it again restores and repeats itself. All right. So this is what the plus polarization does to your ring of particles. As the wave passes by, it starts squeezing the ring into this and that, and this and that. OK, you can download nice movies in Wikipedia or whatever. OK, so that's the plus-plus polarization. So now you may be interested in the cross-polarization. Cross-polarization meaning I am setting epsilon plus equal to 0, and I just consider epsilon cross to be non-trivial. OK, so now if you do epsilon cross, then again, you start with this thing here. But, and you will see basically the same, exactly the same pattern, except that the pattern is now twisted by 45 degrees. So instead of going like that, you will go like this, and then you restore, and then you go like that, and then you restore, and that's the second polarization of the gravitational wave. And this is what LIGO measures. So LIGO has two long arms, right? And it measures. So LIGO would look like something like this. There's one arm here and another arm here. And it basically measures how much longer one arm is getting and how much shorter the other arm is getting. OK, so this is what LIGO is doing. It really measures how the space-time, how the space squeezes as the gravitational wave passes by. All right, so this is the most important picture you should know about gravitational waves. As I said, you should download some pictures from Wikipedia or movies where this is actually really nicely animated, how this actually behaves. So now, how will you prove this? So proof of this. Well, I will not really do the detailed proof, but I will at least tell you what's going on. So, of course, what's really plotted here is that you say, well, all these particles on that ring, they propagate on geodesics. What we are really seeing here is the tidal effects of gravity as the gravitational wave passes by. So, without loss of generality, I can place the center. I can say that the center is not moving, and I'm just describing the motion of the other particles with respect to the motion, with respect to the center. So, center. You say that is sort of static, which means that its four velocity x dot alpha is just 1, 0, and 0. So the center is just standing there. Okay, it's not moving. And then I will measure the deviations from the center of the ring. Okay, so now the ring particles move on geodesics, and the deformation of the ring is described by our favorite geodesic deviation equation. Okay, so deformation of ring is described by geodesic deviation equation. Okay. So let me just remind you what the geodesic deviation equation is. So it was basically really the effect of tidal forces on nearby geodesics, right? So we describe what happens with a star when it orbits around a supermassive black hole. But we can equally describe what happens with the ring of test particles when the gravitational wave passes by, how they move one with respect to another. All right, so the geodesic deviation equation was d square delta x alpha over d tau square equals to, oh no, let me put mu here, mu r mu alpha beta nu x dot beta delta x nu. Okay, so we have the central geodesic, which is the center. It's not moving anywhere. So we have solved the geodesic. It's this one here. And then we are asking, what is the deviation of delta with respect to the center? So this will be something like delta x mu, right? How that moves, how that evolves in time when the central geodesic stays where it is, the center stays where it is, okay? But because the center is not moving, x dot alpha is equal to 1, 0, 0, 0. Okay, what it means is that this thing is 1, 0, 0, 0. This is 1, 0, 0, 0. So the only non-trivial component for this is that one alpha is t, and then beta is t. All right, so this just reduces to r mu tt nu delta x nu. That's the right-hand side. And the left-hand side, well, okay, it contains these nasty covariant derivatives here, two nasty covariant derivatives with respect to time. All right, but we are in linearized gravity. All right, so because we are in linearized gravity, of course, these covariant derivatives, they have partial derivative plus a gamma term. Okay, but we assume that the deviation vector delta x mu is already small. So we kill all gammas, and this is just a partial derivative. All right, so this is equal to d square delta x mu d tau square. So this is by linearization of this, and this is just using the fact that the center is not moving. That's our geodesic equation. Super simple, isn't it? Geodesic deviation equation. All right, So the last thing which we have to do is that we have to calculate the Riemann tensor. Yes?
So if I remember correctly, in general, like, we could have 6 polarizations for the gravitational wave, or is that just, like, why here we only had 2 polarizations of the gravitational wave and not 6?
Oh, because I'm saying, so here, this you can do always. You can always do some coordinate transformations that you bring 4 components of your metric to your desire. Okay, I start with a metric which is 10 component object. I can always do, no matter whether I have energy momentum tensor or, you know, the gravity is strong or whatever, I can always gauge away 4 components of the metric just by doing a coordinate transformation. However, if I am in vacuum, I know that this is at my disposal as well, k squared equals to 0. It's a very special case. But if that is the case, I have 4 additional gauge degrees of freedom. If k squared is not 0, of course, I cannot satisfy this equation. Right? So that will kill my xi mu. Right? So if I impose this thing here, but k squared is not equal to 0, then I cannot do that. So but if I am in vacuum, I have another 4 coordinate transformations at your disposal. And so you have 10 minus 4 minus 4, which is 2. All right, so that's our geodesic equation. So the last thing is we have to write down what r mu dt nu is. But of course, delta x nu is already small. So we can do this in very, very, very weak field approximation. So now we look at our favorite formula from your homework. So now you have r mu nu rho sigma given here is these 4 terms here. And so you have 2 derivatives of the metric of the perturbation. And it's given over here. So of course, all we need is r mu tt nu component. So nu and rho are tt. So nu and rho are tt. So nu and rho are tt. T and t is here. And then mu and rho are tt. So there is t here. And there is t here. And there is t here. And t here. And there is t here. Sorry, did I do?
It's nu.
Nu and rho. Nu and what was it here? That was. Oh no! Now it's gone. it should be t here. Are you saying? And there is nu. Mu.
Mu.
Mu. Mu. And then here something strange. Here, mu. Oh no! It was so beautiful. Should be nu t. I don't know. Whatever. Okay. We will not be able to ever recover this. So anyway, what is important is that there is this first term here. The first term is just a derivative with respect to time of my metric here. On the other hand, this thing here always, well, if you do it properly, will contain like ht something. And ht something and ht something. But if you look at our ht, well, our ht is precisely epsilon mu nu, right? So that's our h mu nu. So now, of course, all the t components are equal to 0. All right, so these terms will actually, if you do it properly, which I didn't, I failed completely, will actually be all 0. And the only term which survives is this one here. All right, so the statement is, and if that r mu t t nu is just 1/2 of t squared t of h mu nu. Okay? So that's the statement which would follow from there if I didn't screw it up. Okay? So our geodesic deviation equation is now super simple. It's this one here. Where that is just 1/2 dt h mu nu. So let me just write it. So then we have d square of delta x mu d tau square equals to 1/2 delta x nu d square over dt square h mu nu. By the way, I changed tau to t, which is okay because this is everything is moving slowly. So that's our geodesic deviation equation. But now my delta x mu, of course, measures the deviations of the particles of the ring, right? And so these things will have mostly non-trivial components, delta y and delta z. Okay, so it'll be a zero here, it'll be something. So delta y, delta z. So now I can write down this equation for delta y and delta z, right? So I can write, for example, so for delta y, that's my component. So I have d square of delta y divided by dt square equals to 1/2. So now, of course, this metric depends on whether I take plus polarization or cross polarization. So let me take the plus polarization. Okay, so take delta y and take epsilon plus non-trivial and set epsilon cross equal to 0. If epsilon cross is equal to 0, the only non-trivial components of my metric are the diagonal components, yy and zz. Right? That's the epsilon plus and epsilon y. Okay, so in this case, delta x nu, so now this is diagonal. So it will be yy, and so this will be y again. So it's 1/2 delta y d square over dt square. And then hyy is just epsilon plus. And then I have to write the exponential as well, e to I k times x, right? That's what my h mu nu looks like. On the other hand, if I write it for delta z, then, well, okay, so it's d square delta z dt square equals to, again, my metric is diagonal. So now will be hzz. But my hzz is minus epsilon plus. But there will be an extra minus here. So it's minus 1/2 delta z d square over dt square of epsilon plus e to I k times x. So I have these two equations, and I should be able to solve them. Okay. The trick is that you don't need an exact solution. All you need is a perturbative solution which captures to linear order what is happening. Okay, so to leading order, it's easy to convince yourself that to leading order. Well, you see that if I choose this delta y at time equal to 0, this thing I can pull it through and it will basically be satisfied. All right, so the two leading order, the solution will be delta y is delta y at time equal to 0 plus 1/2 delta y at time equal to 0 times epsilon plus e to I k times x. Okay, just plug it into that equation. You will see that it works, the linear order. For delta z, it's the same thing, but now I have a minus here, so it will be minus. So delta z at time t is delta z at time 0 minus 1/2 delta z at time 0 epsilon plus e to I k times x. And so you see that how my position of the particle fluctuates. So if, let's say, epsilon, well, okay, so if this guy is getting bigger, that guy is getting smaller. So if y, delta y is getting bigger, this one is getting smaller. And so we are getting oscillation like that. If this one is getting smaller, this one is getting bigger. So we get an oscillation like that. That's precisely described by the first picture. Okay, so that's how you would do epsilon plus. Of course, epsilon cross is exactly the same thing. But now you would have to set epsilon plus equal to 0. And so you would have off diagonal term. So that will be now y coupling to z. And that's why this is 45 degrees twisted. Okay, so epsilon cross would be similar. And you can do it yourself if you want or not. But that's not an exercise. So it will not be, maybe, part of your interview. All right. So this is how you would derive such beautiful picture over there. Questions? All right. So, you know, don't remember this. It's not really important. This is like really showing you how to solve the geodesic deviation equation. And in principle, now you can derive those pictures yourself. But it's not really super crucial for our lives. So now, let me just have a remark. So the statement was that if quantized, if field quantized, this will correspond to spin 2 graviton, spin 2 particle, called graviton. So now there is a beautiful relation between what happens at the classical case and what happens at the quantum case. And basically, if you know how the pictures for your spin polarization, for your polarizations of waves look like at the classical level, you know what is the spin of the particle. So there is a beautiful formula. Is that the spin S is related. Related to the angle theta under which the polarization mode invariant. So you do a rotation to your polarization thing, and you find that if you rotate by a suitable angle theta, under which the picture does not change, it exactly transforms to itself, then you conclude that the spin of the particle is simply 360 degrees divided by this angle theta. Okay? So that's a statement. How you transform a classical property of a wave to actually something like a spin property of a particle when you quantize it. So in particular, you look at those pictures there. And these ones here. And so then you are asking, okay, so I have a shape, let's say the second one. Well, the first one doesn't help me much. But the second one, okay, so the second one, I have this oblate shape here. So under which rotation this thing actually goes to itself. Okay, so if I rotate this, oh, that's wrong. If I rotate this under 45 degrees, I get that. Well, that's not exactly what I had before. If I rotate by 90 degrees, this is what I get. I'm still not there. So this is still not there. So, but if I rotate by 180 degrees, I come to the same point. Okay, so the same thing, of course, here. The same thing, of course, here. So you have to rotate by 180 degrees to get the same polarization pattern. Okay, so that's very crude. I'm not proving this statement, but it's simply true.
It worked for a photon.
So gravity, what do you think? So gravity, the theta is 180 degrees. And so we conclude that the spin of the particle is actually 2. So now for electromagnetism, so standard picture is that I have E and I have B. Right? So what do I have to do in order to, you know, make this do the same thing? Well, I have to rotate by the whole 360 degrees. Otherwise, I wouldn't come to the same thing. Okay, so in electromagnetism, of course, it works. And the theta would be 360 degrees. And so spin would be equal to 1. The funny thing is, of course, for fermion. Okay, so once you have fermion, you know that you should be rotating by 720 degrees to come to the same polarization pattern. which actually I cannot imagine how to do. But there are some clever ways how to actually visualize that you need to go twice. All right, so for fermion, you would find that it's equal to 1/2. But this is a little bit misleading because, of course, fermions are quantum things, and so there is no really fermionic waves. Fermionic waves would be like classical waves, and because this is just purely quantum thing. But yeah, you have to go 700 degrees to come to the same point. All right, so we have spin two particle. And as simple as just reading the pattern from here, it gives you the information that what you are looking for is spin two. Of course, that's not the whole story, right? So we are just doing gravity, linearized gravity around flat space. We are just doing this bloody equation here, which is really not interesting, right? So this field here, it's a linearized equation. It's a linearized gravity. We've thrown away all self-interactions, all interesting things which are contained in the Einstein equation here. So only at the linear level, you can say that there is actually a spin two graviton, which can describe your field theory. So only on flat background, we have excitations corresponding to spin two particle. If you are in general curve space, there is no way how you can decompose this general curve space into some background and some small perturbation. And then it's very difficult to say, you know, what would be the corresponding particle. So in general curve space, you know, the particle is self-interacting, it's doing lots of strange things. So of course this will not be true. You can only do it in, you know, we are doing only quantum field theory in flat space-time if the gravity is super weak. And then you are not really describing the full notion of gravity. You are just describing the linearized equations. All right, so the last remark here is that this is done in Sean Carroll's books and find it neat. So if you consider a string, okay, so you can vibrate a string of closed string. So take a string, right? So string is this thing here, right? And so let's take originally to be a circle. So now you can actually vibrate it in three different ways. There are three basic vibration modes of a closed string. So one of them is called breezing mode. And basically what it tells you is that you can make the ring a little bit smaller, or you can make the ring a little bit bigger. So it's like oscillations like this. That's called the breezing mode. Which is something new. But then actually what the ring can do for the string is actually it can start vibrating precisely like this. It can go like that, and then later go like that, which is precisely the friction one. Or it can go like that and go like that. And that's the picture two. So you can have epsilon plus polarization and you have epsilon cross polarization. And so that's it. So there are these three modes, which actually a closed string can do if you study what the string can do. And of course, this corresponds to spin two particle, spin two, so the graviton. And this thing, actually changing the volume of the picture, corresponds to spin zero particle called dilaton. Okay, spin zero, which is a dilaton. It's a scale particle. And so you see that immediately closed strings, they describe theory where you have gravitons and where you have scale particles. Okay? So now, certainly, string theory, if you quantize it, it's a theory of quantum gravity, a theory of quantum gravity. It may not be the theory of quantum gravity, but certainly it is a theory. A theory of quantum gravity. And let me just leave it here. All right. Questions? Huh.
Why is the spin two particle necessarily graviton?
I was just trying to convince you that not necessarily, right? At the linearized level, yes, but there's a long way from linearized field equations to the Einstein equations, to full non-general relativity, full general relativity. Okay, so what you can really show is that if you start from here, from linearized things, which is a theory of spin two particle. So here it is a set on a theory of spin two particle on a flat Minkowski background. So then the question is, how do I go to Einstein equations? Can I actually do small perturbation of this and, you know, whatever? So you need to include the self interactions of the particle. This is certainly self interacting. We know that even in vacuum, there is non-trivial gravitational fields, right? So this will be certainly highly non-trivial self interacting particle. And people spend lots of time actually going from special relativity of spin two to full nonlinear theory. I may give you some comments on it maybe on Thursday if I have time. If not, the person who has really done all the work is Deser. So he has done all the work. How you go from here to there? Feynman also did some work on this. It's highly non-trivial. You have to be truly genius to guess what the nonlinear equations are. They cannot really be derived unless you already know the result. All right. So it's very, very non-trivial to go from spin two flat space field theory to the full general relativity.
We don't get the dilaton here, right? When we use general relativity.
Of course, no. So the first mode is special to string. It doesn't exist in general relativity. So this what it means is that basically you describe three degrees of freedom here, right? So your basic degrees of freedom are the scalar, and then you have two degrees of freedom for the graviton. So now, of course, this is not observed. Well, we don't know if there is any dilaton in our real universe. So either you have to make it so massive that you don't observe it, or you have to somehow get rid of it, right? So we only observe gravity, we don't observe the dilaton. Yes?
How would you measure? Is it measurable?
It depends on how it couples to other things, right? I have no idea. All right, we don't have much time, but let me just start discussing really, you know, the interesting question is, and that's where the exciting part about gravity waves is really that they have been measured, right? So we really have sources of gravitational waves in our universe, and we want to measure how much energy from these sources actually radiated away and how much energy we can actually measure as observers. And so that will be our next task. So let's say that we have a collision of two massive black holes in a binary system. And then let's calculate how much energy is actually radiated away and how much energy we can measure on Earth. Right? And that's what really all the interest now is about. So the next section will be, the subsection will be gravitational radiation from an isolated system. And so, of course, what we have in mind is that, let's say, we have a collision of two black holes, or collision of two stars, so they orbit around each other. And so they orbit like that, and they finally merge because the system is losing energy. Oh, no. And then, okay, so what it means is that we have some region of space-time where we have non-trivial T mu nu, so non-trivial source. So T mu nu is not equal to zero here. And let's say we choose some origin of coordinates, let's say associated with one of the stars. And then we describe the system or the non-trivial T mu nu with some coordinate r prime. Okay, so if it's just a binary system, the r prime will be only, there'll be only non-trivial matter, the other star here. So r prime would have to go there. But if it's surrounding objects as well, then r prime can take, you know, whatever. All right. And so now we have a distant observer. So there's an observer here looking at that. And observer is, of course, much further away and the vector to the observer is R. So again, I start from here and I measure R. And so the realistic situation, we have an isolated system, isolated source of gravitational waves. So this thing, when the T-mu is non-trivial, is actually finite. And then everywhere else, of course, we have T-mu equal to zero. There's no energy momentum tensor. And then we observe how much gravitational waves is actually produced in the system, and how do we observe that. So that's the goal which we want to do. And in order our approximation, well, in order to do that, we need to introduce some approximation. And so one of the approximations, of course, is that R prime, the magnitude of R prime, is much, much smaller than R. So we are very, very far away from the system. That's one approximation. And the other approximation is that whatever is happening here, of course, you can go beyond that. But in the first order, let's assume that the sources in our isolated system move slowly. Okay, so this really, they can be some time change of the orbit or whatever, but it's relatively slow. It's not moving. You don't have objects moving at the speed of light. Okay, so then the other thing is that the frequency, which is the characteristic frequency of the system, for example, the period of this thing, is much smaller than 1 over R prime. So basically, the size of the system is much bigger than the speed of light. So that's the slow motion. So omega is the characteristic frequency of the source. So for example, you know how quickly these stars orbit each other. And so this will be saying that it's actually quite slow motion. All right, so this is what we want to do. Okay, this is our bloody equation which we want to solve. The field is still weak. But now, of course, we have sources, right? We are interested how the stars produce the gravitational waves. So we will have the full equation with non-trivial T mu nu on the right-hand side. Okay, so now, of course, what is the solution of this equation here? It's similar to electromagnetism. The solution of this, well, the general solution will be, well, an arbitrary solution of the homogeneous equation where the right-hand side is equal to zero, which is waves, plus the special solution with the non-trivial T mu nu. Do we know what that solution is? If you look at this equation here, and you remind yourself the equation for the vector potential in the Maxwell field, which we done in the front end, it's exactly the same equation. Okay, so of course it has exactly the same solution, which is the retarded potentials. Okay, so the special solution. So we have to solve equation, which is box on h mu nu bar equals to minus 16 pi g t mu nu. And the special solution is given by the green function corresponding to box, which we constructed in the front-end course. And it's just given by the retarded potential if we don't consider the advanced one. Right? So it's just a special solution given by retarded potentials and so h mu nu bar at time t and distance r is given. Okay, so now I don't know, remember what was that. So in the electromagnetic case we had minus 4 pi j mu, right? So this is 4 times bigger. And there's a G there. So that's why there's 4G, which is different from electromagnetism in front of the integral. And it's an integral d3 r prime. And then T mu nu is the source at retarded time r prime divided by r minus r prime. this thing here, where the retarded time is just t minus r prime. That's the formula which we derived in the front end, but now for electromagnetic field. But of course, the equation is exactly the same, so the solution has to be exactly the same. That's the retarded potential for the gravitational field. All right, so we have the solution, so let's play with it and let's use this approximation. So that's the last thing I'll be able to do today. So let's consider that we have this solution here, and let's write it in the Fourier space. All right, so let's do a Fourier transformation of that solution, but only in the time direction. So I am replacing time with omega frequency, and that will be the Fourier transformation of this solution here. So it's 1 over square root of 2 pi, and then dt e to I omega t h mu nu bar. That's the Fourier transformation. All right, so now you have to plug in the solution, which is 4g d3r prime, d mu nu of tr and r prime. All right, so very good. So this is equal to this is equal to 4g. Square root of 2 pi, and then integral dt and integral d3 r prime e to I omega t mu nu of tr and r prime, and then r minus r prime. Okay, yeah, just using that solution there. Okay, so now we want to integrate over time. But if you look at your formula for the retarded time is basically time minus something. Okay, so changing from integration over time to integration over retarded time has a Jacobian equal to 1. So if I do just a coordinate change from t to tr prime, so now change coordinates, change t to tr. Okay, so we want to integrate over tr, and the Jacobian is equal to 1. All right, so if you do it, so this is just equal to 4g over square root of 2 pi. So now we integrate over retarded time instead of time, and we integrate over r prime still. Okay, and then, of course, I had I omega t here. So I have to plug there I omega tr plus r minus r prime. I omega tr plus r minus r prime. And then t mu nu of tr and r prime and r minus r prime. Okay, just the change of variables. T to TR. You seem completely exhausted. All right, so we'll be done soon, in 1 minute. All right, so now, of course, what you can do is that you can integrate over TR. Okay, how do you do that? The appearance of TR is here. The appearance of tr is here, and the appearance of tr is here. So what we are really doing is that if we integrate over tr, we are actually doing a Fourier transformation of this t mu nu from time tr to frequency omega. So we can do the integral over tr by just saying this is just t mu nu in the Fourier space, the function of omega. All right, so this is equal to, and that eats the square root of 2 pi. So this is equal to 4g. And then it's an integral over d3 r prime, and then e to I omega r minus r prime. And then we have t mu nu tilde, which is now a function of omega and r prime, and then r minus r prime. Okay, we just did integration over tr. Basically, we said this is just a Fourier transformation of our t mu nu. All right, so finally, if you look at this thing here, okay, we have r minus r prime. We have an observer who is very, very far away, and system which is quite isolated and small. Of course, r prime is much, much smaller than r, right? So we can neglect r prime here, and we can neglect r prime here. All right, and that's our result. So we have a beautiful result, is that this is something like 4g e to I omega r divided by r, and then d3 r prime t mu nu omega r prime. And that's what our h mu nu tilde looks like.
So that's in the monopole approximation. We could do higher dipole.
Yeah. Well, of course. Okay. Yes. Well. So what we are interested in is, of course, the radiation. How much gravitational waves are radiated away, right? So of course that means that you want to integrate this over a sphere, right? But what you typically want to integrate over a sphere is something like h mu nu squared. So you need something which falls off like 1 over r. So that h mu nu square goes like 1 over r square. If you integrate over sphere, it will give you r square sine theta, and that will give you a non-trivial contribution. So what we are really interested in is something which falls off like 1 over r. That's the radiative field, right? And that's what we precisely have here. So that's the formula where we start from tomorrow. And so remember, we have a great goal. We want to calculate how much gravitational waves is produced from an isolated system, and how much radiation, how much power we can actually observe on the Earth. So that's our goal for tomorrow. Questions? All right.